From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the October 2015 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Forgotten Genius. Bletchley Park is bathed in autumn sunshine as we take you to the opening of a brand new fascinating exhibition about Gordon Welchman, Bletchley Park's architect of ultra intelligence. We'll hear from Welchman's granddaughter, Jennifer, who flew in specially to be at the launch, and from his Hut 6 colleague, Jimmy Thirsk, who at the age of 101 is one of the last few of his kind. We'll also hear from the grandson of a man who was involved in codebreaking in both world wars, Nigel de Grey. His grandson, Anthony, is clearly proud of his roots, and his grandfather was not the only member of his family who worked at Bletchley Park. But first, Bletchley Park presents Gordon Carrera. On the 18th of October, the BBC's security correspondent will give a talk at Bletchley Park about his new book, which traces the intertwined history of computing and espionage, Intercept, the Secret History of Computers and Spies. He told the Bletchley Park podcast how a book about technology turned out to be a book about people. Now, it's sort of an obvious question to ask how the idea for this book came about, because obviously you're steeped in stories of espionage. But tell me from the beginning how it came to be.
Well, the book's a history of how computers and spies have, I suppose, interacted over the decades. So it's about how the computer was, to some extent, born in the world of espionage at Bletchley Park. But in turn, moving on from there, how the history of the computer has been shaped by spying and by espionage, but also how the world of spying has been changed by computers and how spying today has been changed by computers. Code breaking is a kind of central theme of it, but it's also more broadly about the kind of intercepting of communications and the world of kind of computers and data, which we now inhabit and which is pretty important for all of us. So it's a history book in which Bletchley is at the start and to some extent is there all the way through the story and the experience and the legacy of Bletchley, but which very much goes up to today and goes into the future.
It's all pervading now, isn't it? You cannot really live without the internet now, whether you choose to not have it in your home, which is even now quite an extreme thing to do. So could you see people feeling a bit nervous about this subject and thinking, oh, I don't want to think too much about how much I'm being spied on?
Well, one of the things I'd say, first of all, it's not a technical book. It's not for computer experts. It's a history book for people who are interested in Bletchley and interested in the Cold War and interested in modern issues. So it's not technical. It's not designed to scare people or to be intimidating, but to hopefully give the general public an understanding of how important this subject is and the history behind it, because it is important, because even if it does sound a bit intimidating, these issues to do with kind of privacy, surveillance, espionage, intelligence, what different countries are doing are really important for our world. And so what I hope is that the book gives people an understanding of that and a real appreciation of where it comes from and therefore what it means for us.
Can you remember when you started thinking, I really ought to write a book about all this?
Well,
because this is the work you do, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd written a previous book on MI6. I'd done a lot of reporting at Bletchley over years and have loved going there. And I've always been fascinated by it, been fascinated by the origins of code breaking, but also how it went forward. I'd done a lot of work then on the modern intelligence agencies and GCHQ, and had made Radio 4 programmes inside GCHQ. And I wanted partly to connect those two things up, Bletchley then, GCHQ now. Then you've got all the kind of current debates about surveillance and privacy. Wanted to feed that in, computer hacking, cyber espionage. Also look at how that world relates to that of MI6 and traditional intelligence, if you like. And so there was a huge array of issues. And then the difficult thing was trying to shape that into a book.
It's a ball of wool,
and there's so many different elements to it. But actually, they do connect up. And, I start the book actually in World War One rather than World War Two, with the kind of origins of communications intelligence and code breaking and, the interception of mail and of telegraph cables. But then actually, by starting at Bletchley in World War Two, you get a real sense of what could be done with the melding of technology and people, code breaking, its central importance. And you can look at how that works through the Cold War to today. And what's amazing, of course, is that Bletchley was so secret. What they did there, the kind of dealing with encryption, was something which was incredibly closed and secretive. And yet now we're all using encryption technology. You know, when we bank online, we're using encryption technology. When we do some of our communications on the internet, it's a matter of public debate how much encryption should be out there, what kind of encryption. So you can see how this issue has moved from being one of the most secret to actually a very important issue of today.
And I imagine it would be completely at odds with your position at the BBC as a newsman to take a view and to take a position on.
Yeah, people often say to me, you know, where do you stand on the kind of, you know, Edward Snowden and on the surveillance and security versus privacy? You know, with the BBC, you've got to take an impartial view. But actually, that helped with writing the book, because the book is a history book. And what I'm trying to do is say, how did we get here? How did it start? What are the issues? And here's an impartial, I hope, history.
Well, history is a matter of opinion.
It is, it is. But it's, you know, all you can do is aspire to be impartial, which is what I'm trying to do. It's not an argumentative book where you're saying you should end up thinking this. But the idea is you give people history and then they can make up their own minds. So you want to give them the fact in as impartial way as possible and then let them make up their own mind.
You must have got incredible access to information to write this history, because I would say information up to 1945 is very freely available now. It gets a bit tricky after that.
It does.
You must be a very trusted contact.
Well, I've worked in this field for 10 years, 11 years covering security. I mean, I've covered some of the issues
just
even before that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's taken a long time, yeah, it's fair to say, to work out. And actually, this world of communications intelligence is perhaps the most secretive. GCHQ, in many ways, had been the most secretive of the intelligence agencies, more so even than MI6. And so it is a difficult field to cover. But over time, you learn about it, you report on it, you cover it. I made some documentaries on GCHQ. I made one, I think, in 2010 called Cracking the Code, in which we got into GCHQ for Radio 4 for the first time.
And it's quite a coup.
And it was quite a coup, and it was really interesting. They're interested in opening up now, but then it was quite a big deal. And it was great because we sat down with code breakers, you know, if you like, the modern day successors to Alan Turing, you know, mathematicians who sat there breaking codes and talked to them a bit about that. And it's all on the radio, you can hear it. You know, it wasn't secret that we were doing this. In fact, it was broadcast. But that made me understand and think about those links, you know, between how's code breaking done now? How is it done at Bletchley? What are the differences? And to try and explain that, look at how machines and computers are important, but still the human brain and people are still vital in this business.
And to report so successfully on things that are essentially secret, you must have to be prepared to meet people somewhere along a line between open and closed, and be trusted to know things by people that you work with and not broadcast.
Well, I mean, that's true to some extent with lots of bits of journalism where people tell you stuff off the record and on background. And, you know, politicians will do that with, but yeah, with political correspondence. So it happens in lots of fields. You know, the one thing I would say is that, I think it's important that there is an element of accountability and openness and transparency to an extent with intelligence agencies' work. Now, you know, those agencies will always say there are certain things which have to remain secret. But a lot of the interesting discussion now is what really needs to remain secret. You know, agents' identity, certainly. Some of the specific techniques in code breaking, you know, certainly. Those are the arguments about that. But actually, there's a lot of other stuff which can be explained to the public and which can be talked about to the public. You know, the momentum is very much towards openness and towards, you know, greater transparency and accountability. And I think, you know, that's definitely the trend within the intelligence agencies. It's not just for imposed from the outside, but I think they recognise that's the direction things are going.
Can you tell me about some of the characters you spoke to and some of the people who'd been involved in sort of the development of technology?
What I enjoyed about the book is the stories, and some of the stories, you know, whether it's about the characters and researching some of the characters from the Second World War, and whether it's Turing or Tommy Flowers, whether it's some of the Americans who came to Bletchley. I think that's a fascinating story. And I try and tell that in quite a lot of detail in the book, because I think it's the birth of this modern communications intelligence relationship. But then, you know, if you go through into the modern world of hackers and computers, you know, there's some really fascinating stories there about some of the people who've been involved in it. Some of the people who were the first to spot how computers could be hacked and could be manipulated, and some of the risks that were there from the 60s, from the 80s. And, you know, I enjoy those stories. It's much more about the stories than it is about, if you like, the simple technology of it. Well, it comes down to people. You know, we think it's all about machines, but actually machines are built and designed by people. They're used by people. If there's a lesson from Bletchley, of course, in breaking, you know, Enigma and some of the other traffic, it's that you can design a very good machine, but some of the weaknesses are the way people use it. You know, people are still the ones who have to input those codes and, you know, what settings they use.
but the shortcuts and laziness.
And the shortcuts and the laziness. And you know what? It's very similar today. It's the equivalent of, you know, using an easy password.
Yeah.
You know, when you start to think about it, you can see the continuities between what was done then and what's done now in code breaking. It's very interesting how much continuity there is between Bletchley and between today. Certainly some differences, and computers have changed some of the aspects of spying. But in some of the worlds of code breaking, you know, it's not as different as you might think.
Can I get you to cast your mind back to the first time you covered a story about Bletchley Park, or the first time you became interested in it?
Well, I mean, I've been there so many times now. A lot of the visits are etched in my mind, whether it was the ceremony where the badges were handed out, that was quite an important one, or when the Queen came. But also, I mean, I remember going round, it wasn't that long ago, some of the huts which hadn't been renovated and had been almost untouched since the war, and kind of given a guided tour, and we did a piece about it for the TV.
Pre-restoration. Yeah.
You know, you were walking around and there was water dripping everywhere. There's still some of the chalk marks on the doors from wartime or just after wartime. You would step on something and think, is that a dead something or other? It was very atmospheric.
Yeah.
But then to go back in the last year and see how those places have been restored and renovated was absolutely astounding, to see what a great job it had been done. And also to see how it hadn't lost the atmosphere and the character. And to see the changes in Bletchley in the, I don't know how many years, 10 years or so, that I've been going there, has been amazing.
Oh, it's stratospheric, isn't it? I've only been working there for 3 years and it's barely recognisable.
Yeah.
I hope you make many more happy memories of visits.
I hope so. I'm sure there'll be more to come. Thank you.
Gordon's talk is on Sunday the 18th of October. The last few tickets are on sale in the Bletchley Park shop, both in the visitor centre and online. Next month, Bletchley Park presents the GCHQ Departmental Historian. On Sunday the 15th of November, Tony Comer will give a top secret talk. Details will be declassified soon. Watch our website for details. Throughout October and November, we bring you making, doing, singing and maths. We're putting on 6 half-day events for families who want to support their children's learning in maths and have fun at the same time. These events are designed for 5 to 12-year-olds and their grown-ups, although younger siblings are welcome to come along too. Check the website for dates and availability, then just turn up and join in. Anthony de Grey has a rich history of code-breaking running through his family tree. Both his grandfather and father worked at Bletchley Park during World War II, and his grandfather was one of a smaller number of codebreakers, paving the way for the government code and cipher school some 20 years earlier, during World War I. Anthony caught up with podcast producer Mark Cotton at Bletchley Park Presents Jack Copeland.
I'm now lucky enough to be with another very proud member of the De Grey family.
Indeed.
We've just been stood here talking for a few minutes about your grandfather and your father. And the pride, again, in your face, it's just so obvious. Maybe give us a bit more background to the World War II side of the story.
Yes, certainly. As is well known in history, of course, my grandfather Nigel came here at the beginning of the war and worked here throughout the war, ended up being deputy director to Travis, and he was also in charge of information exchange, and my father ended up taking over information exchange at the end of the war.
It's quite a family affair, code breaking, isn't it, for the De Greys?
It does seem to be, because not only was my grandfather and my father here, but also my aunt and the man that she married were also here during the Second World War. So it's very much a family affair. And I think that this comes about through there being a lot of music in the family, a lot of art. My grandmother was the finest amateur soprano of her day. My grandfather Nigel wrote music for revues to accompany plays and so on. And they always say maths and music are very closely involved.
They are. I'm a musician myself, and you're counting beats, you're counting bars. We get the same from our wireless operators and our Morse listeners, that the very musical ones are really good at that. I think us musicians are much underrated.
Well, I couldn't agree more. But speaking as a very poor musician, perhaps that would make me a very poor code breaker. So we better not go down that route.
But Nigel wasn't a poor musician, was he, at all?
No, he wasn't. He was a good musician. We have no record of any of the music he wrote, sadly. And of course, there are no recordings extant because nobody ever did record it. We have a lot of record of what my father wrote by way of music, but sadly not of Nigel.
So was your father a composer as well then?
Yes, he was, very much so. I think he was probably a better composer than Nigel.
Really?
Well, he trained as a concert pianist. I mean, he studied under somebody called Alfred Cortot in Paris, who was one of the last century's five greatest pianists. He then came back for further studies in London, and sadly, he was advised that his hands weren't big enough, which is actually nonsense. And so he never became a pianist, and I think that affected him for the rest of his life. I think he would have been much happier to have tried and found that it wasn't going to work than to have
always, have that
always wondering.
That wonder, yeah.
I know of one piano recital he gave because I have the flyer for it, but I suspect he gave others. I'd be very surprised if he stopped at one, because he was a very, very good pianist.
Your father, it's an interesting tale how he was recruited to Bletchley Park, isn't it?
Yes, my father was working at the BBC at the outbreak of war, and he was living with my mother at Hatfield, and they were able to see London being bombed from there. And in due course, the BBC was evacuated out to Caversham at very short notice, and so my parents had to find somewhere to live, and they ended up lodging with Nigel. He was here at the beginning of the war, so this would have been 1941, 1942. Now, Nigel had a party for all the great and good at Bletchley Park, including Alistair Denniston. And at this cocktail party, Denniston was talking to my grandfather and then said, "Who's that young man over the other side of the room? I want to meet him." And that's how my father ended up at Bletchley Park.
And he actually took over some of the roles of your grandfather, didn't he? Your grandfather moved on.
At the very end of the war, yes. He started off, and this actually I originally found out by going to the public records office at Kew, thanks to Tony Sale, who put me on the right course as to how to set about it. Anyway, so he started off helping to manage the Y stations, and he wrote and gave speeches encouraging the staff, sort of in charge of morale, but just generally making sure the Y stations were running well as well. But he wrote
they were our first link in that.
Without the Y stations, Bletchley wouldn't have anything to do.
That's what some of our ladies have said quite strongly.
Yes. I mean, I've read some of these speeches, and it is fascinating because he very carefully doesn't tell them why they're doing, or he hardly mentions what they're doing, but he emphasises how important it is without giving the game away to them at all. And so that's all we really know about what he did here during the war. But at the same time, his sister was here. Barbara had the most beautiful hand, and she kept the Japanese Air Force card index. So the reason that, as I'm sure everybody knows, this is so important is so that if you see that Flight Lieutenant Yamamoto has been posted somewhere, you know that he's a dive bomber pilot, so you know there's going to be a dive bomber squadron arriving there sooner or later. So this was the significance of it. Her husband also worked here. He was also on the Japanese side. But going back to when my father first started here, my grandmother drew my mother aside and said, "My dear, you do realise, don't you, that you can't even now ask him if he's had a good day." Such was the secrecy that was held dear by the family.
I guess in a way that's one advantage that maybe your father had, that because your grandfather had lived through that, as opposed to some people, your father was a little bit let in on the secret to start with, wasn't he?
Well, he was let into the secret of keeping secret. It came with his mother's milk. So he took it totally on board. My mother, of course, coming in from outside, probably had no idea what Nigel had done at all at the beginning of the war, or even what he was doing during the war, until my father actually went to Bletchley Park, when she obviously knew he was there, but that was all she knew. My father died much too young, age 61, having never said anything to anyone. The only thing he did mention to me was when I came across a Russian phrase book. And I asked him about it, and he said, oh, yes, well, we did keep an eye on the Russian train movements, because that was very significant. Now, I think this was after the war, because he stayed on for a while after. Again, we don't really know, but he was supposed to be going off to the Foreign Office, was the story after the war.
Well, of course, even during the war, the Foreign Office was a big cover for Bletchley. You know, yes. A lot of people were actually Foreign Office staff.
Yeah, so we assume that he carried on after the war, and I think that this Russian bit was probably what he was doing after the war. At some point, I don't know exactly when, my father left. I would guess when it was transferred, or was going to be transferred down to Cheltenham. And at the same time, my grandfather had bought a pottery up in Huntingdon to retire to. Now, my uncle, Roger, who was an artist, was teaching up in Newcastle and wasn't interested in taking it over. My father, having by then left Bletchley Park, I confess I don't know exactly what he was doing. We just don't know. No. He may still have been involved, for all I know. So he ended up taking over the pottery in Huntingdon because Nigel de Grey dropped down dead the day the sale of the pottery was completed.
Again, he died very young, didn't he? He was only 64,
65? 65. So both of them died incredibly young, unfairly young.
Yes, definitely.
And I was musing to myself whether the pressures and stresses of being here might have had something to do with it.
I mean, it's such a tragedy. I mean, both of them, in different ways, did so much for their country in the worst two conflicts of probably all time, let alone the 20th century, that to die so early and not, I suppose, in a way, reap the benefits of that freedom, it does seem like they were cheated, really, doesn't it?
I think so. And I think it's also very sad, of course, in retrospect, that the people who were so closely involved never got the opportunity to speak, as many did have later on. So when my mother died, much, much later, she had no idea what my father had done. She still didn't. The research I carried out at the PRO was after she had died. So she died not knowing what he'd done either. And I think that's sad for her too. So there is a, you know, it passes down the generations.
Definitely.
Some of this, it's like a lost opportunity, but the opportunity was never there. And that's the worst thing.
But I think it's a lovely tribute to both of them, that both you and Michael, as I said in the interview with Michael, obviously the listeners can't see this, but the pride in your face, again, when you talk about both of them, is absolutely wonderful. And it's so nice. And you are keeping their history alive and helping us to tell people about this history.
Yes. Well, as I said earlier, I find it spine-tingling to walk into the mansion, knowing I'm walking where my grandfather and my father walked but never could tell anyone. And I find it difficult to hold back the tears at a time like that. It means so much. And then suddenly to buy the guidebook today and to find two photographs of my father in it, doing amateur dramatics.
Absolutely wonderful to be able to share these memories with our listeners and to get both sides of the story, the World War One story and now from you the World War Two story. So thank you very much, Anthony.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity, because I'm just delighted to contribute to this place, which is still far too secret.
Jennifer Welchman's grandfather kept his war work secret for more than 30 years, like all of his thousands of colleagues. But when he published his memoirs in the early 80s, he was described by GCHQ as a disastrous example to others. Now Gordon Welchman's wartime work is being celebrated in a new exhibition at Bletchley Park. In the words of his granddaughter, the scene of his proudest achievements. The exhibition was launched by Bletchley Park CEO Ian Standen, the BBC's Make It Digital controller Jessica Cecil, and Dr. Joel Greenberg, on whose biography of Gordon Welchman the exhibition is based.
I'm Ian Standen, the Chief Executive of the Bletchley Park Trust. It's my pleasure to welcome you here today to this launch of the Gordon Welchman exhibition in this finally restored room in the mansion of Bletchley Park. For those who know Bletchley Park well, you'll know that only 6 months ago this was another rundown space, but now been transformed into this wonderful room that we stand in today. A few welcomes, particularly today. We have Jennifer Welshman, Gordon Welshman's granddaughter, Julie Mayfield, his goddaughter, James Thurst, who's working in Hut 6 and knew Gordon Welshman well, and Bessie Webb, another one of our Bletchley Park veterans. So welcome to you all here for this important event. I'm going to stop talking now and hand over to Jessica Cecil from BBC, who's the controller of the Make It Digital campaign, which is the campaign that BBC is running at the moment, of which this documentary about Gordon Welshman has been a key part. So Jessica, over to you.
Thank you very much. Yes, I am in charge of Make It Digital, which is trying to inspire a new generation to get creative with coding, programming and digital technology. But this is where it all starts. And Betty Webb, thank you very much for being included in the film that we launched the entire season with, which gives an indication of how important Bletchley is to the entire story. What Make It Digital is all about is empowerment, that through people taking their first steps in understanding coding and computing and creating, they can start to shape their digital world. That's obviously now relevant to absolutely everybody, but in the middle of the last century, it was right here that that story played out, and that's why we were incredibly proud to have this documentary as one of the key tentpoles in the entire Make It Digital content season, which has played out in the last couple of weeks and has been watched by 23 million people. The thing I found particularly moving about it was the way in which the story of Gordon Welshman was both about computer science, but it was also about a personal journey of discovery. And what we're hoping is that through an understanding of what people feel that they are capable of through coding and digital creativity, they can actually do more for themselves. So I couldn't be more grateful and proud to be here.
I'm now going to introduce Dr. John Greenberg, who is Gordon Welshman's biographer, and he's going to give you a very quick overview about Gordon Welshman for those who don't yet understand how important he was to the Bletchley Park story. So, John, thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's hard to capture a man of it to 79 years and had such a varied career in 10 minutes, but I'll do my best. First, as a career at Cambridge, ended up at Cambridge, Sydney, Sussex, the dean. His field was algebraic geometry, and he was very successful. Unlike Alan Turing, who pretty much did research, Welshman was a teacher. But he was one of a number, 50-odd, academics who were approached in 1938, who had agreed in the event of war to undertake secret work for the Foreign Office. The after war was declared, Welshman honored his commitment and arrived at Bletchley Park, where he remained throughout the entire war. But almost from day one, for some reason, he had the vision to realize that the approach that was being adopted, the World War I approach, academics, linguists, classicists, tackling encrypted messages one by one, simply didn't scale. And very quickly, he realized that they were talking about something much different. Networks of messages, thousands and tens of thousands of messages. You needed another approach. He drew up a plan, which he presented to the people that ran Bletchley Park, and it was the production model of Bletchley Park for the rest of the war, the famous Hut 6 and 3 and 8 and 4, Army and Air Force Enigma, Naval Enigma, a whole production line approach. Probably the most significant thing, in my opinion, that he did was traffic analysis. In my opinion, far more important than reading encrypted messages. You must remember that the Enigma messages were very short operational messages, 200, 250 characters long. Many of them were very mundane orders for nuts and bolts and screwdrivers. But with each encrypted message, there was information that was not encrypted, which told you who was sending the message, who was receiving the message, etc. People like Jimmy and others were analyzing this, and the information gleaned from that provided more information probably to the Allied command than the actual contents of the individual message itself. A huge, huge contribution. After the war, Welshman, after a brief period, several years working for the John Lewis Partnership, immigrated to the United States, and he got a job at MIT, taught the first course in computing, and was involved in developments of Project Whirlwind, the very first American stored memory computers. But Welshman was not interested in the nuts and bolts of technology. What he was interested in was how technology could be used to solve problems. He was an applications man, and that was his work at MIT. After he left MIT after 4 or 5 years, he drifted around a bit. He suffered the malaise of many people at Bletchley Park. Very difficult to replicate the time here. But he did eventually find his true niche in 1962 when he got a job for something called the MITRE Corporation, an MIT spinoff doing research for the American military. Ideas that Welshman came up with now today lie at the heart of NATO and the Americans' air defense systems. The thing that Welshman is probably best known for people that come to Bletchley Park, is this, the Hutt 6 story, published in 1982, the first published book which actually gave detail of how Bletchley Park accomplished what they did during the war. It depends on your perspective, and I try to be balanced in my book. You can take the view that Welshman was naive, that he was talking about things which he shouldn't have been talking about, they're too sensitive. Equally, you can take the other view that this was essential, that people needed to know this. Exactly the same arguments are being raised about Edward Snowden today. Welshman was threatened with prosecution under the same legislation that Edward Snowden is currently being pursued under. The one thing I can say in conclusion, all my research showed, is that Welshman's intentions for writing this book were entirely honorable. They were not about money. They were not about personal glorification. He simply felt that it was important that people understood the true history of the war. It was important that they understood that security systems were vulnerable and the lessons to be learned. And maybe more poignantly, he felt that many of the people who he had personally recruited, who were employed by the Foreign Office's temporary civil servants, most people did not know what they'd done during the war. There are sad stories of families more or less disowning people. Welshman's own, his first wife, Jenny, grandmother, her family were all military people, and they, my understanding is, had very little to do with him after the war because they thought that he had somehow avoided military service. Some very sad stories. He wanted those people's story to be told. The people that actually did the work in Hutt 6, Dennis Babbage, David Reese, John Harrible, maybe a bit better known, Reg Parker, the sort of people that were the real code breakers at Bletchley Park. So that was his intention for doing this. You make your own judgments about whether he should or shouldn't have done it. For me personally, the fruition of 3 or 4 years of talking to Vicky and the College of Bletchley Park about having a Welshman exhibition here for a long time. So thank you to the Bletchley Park Trust for finally putting it together. Thanks to the BBC for commissioning the program. And it's just a delight to me that Gordon Welshman is now increasingly better known more generally in Britain and the rest of the world. Thanks.
I'm Julia Mayfield, and Gordon lived next door to my parents in Great Grandston during the war. My father was away in India during the war, but my mother and Gordon's wife were very, very friendly. And although I was born after the war, my brother and sister were very good playmates with the two oldest Welshman children.
And Gordon was actually your godfather, I believe.
Yes, he was my godfather, and my mother was godmother to one of his children. So they had each given the other family the honour of keeping a connection, even though we did eventually pretty much lose touch when they went to the States.
Do you remember Gordon at all from, I mean, obviously you were so young.
I don't really remember him, but I have got a letter from him telling me that he came over in 1955 or 56. And I do remember a family coming with three little blonde children. And Gordon gave me a doll, which was a Sparkle Plenty doll. And I just looked it up on the internet, and they do still exist, Sparkle Plenty dolls. But I was very proud of it. He also gave me a brooch, which was in the shape of a griffin. So I was very proud of these, because this is this rather exotic godfather who lived in America. And I had another godmother who lived in Australia, so I always thought I had these rather exotic godparents. I didn't really quite know how exotic Gordon was until much, much later.
I mean, especially as a child in, what, 1955, we were still only just coming out of rationing, weren't we?
Absolutely, yes. And
it must have seemed like another world.
It was another world. And so, as such, I don't really remember much about him, except I did get a letter from him after I got married, very nice chatty letter, saying that he hadn't been a very good godfather. So I wrote back saying, well, probably my mother hadn't been a very good godmother to his children either. And he wrote in that letter that he'd be in touch the following year when he came back to England, but sadly we lost touch after that. So
I think you said your brother, you spoke to him recently, didn't you, knowing that this event was happening today, to get some stories from your brother. And what did your brother remember of Gordon?
My brother remembered playing with Nick Welshman in the garden of the house they lived in Rippington Mallon in Great Grandston, where there was an underground passage between the house and the church. And apparently he and Nick Welshman had wanted to bash this passage done, but and so my brother actually remembers Catherine Welshman being quite cross with them for trying to do that. But and my brother recently was over from Australia and he went to visit the house, and the underground passage is still there, apparently blocked up. They also used to play with another little boy called Robert Lloyd, and also the King of Yugoslavia's son. So they used to play in the stream in Great Grandston.
It's quite a well-connected family you've got there, really, isn't it?
Well, a very tenuous connection there, but...
Was it years later that you realised who Gordon was and what he'd actually done?
Yes. My father, who died about 20 years ago now, he sort of did give some indication that he'd been involved in very important work. But then quite early on, I think when the Hut 6 story was published, we bought it. So I had that book. So when I heard about Joel's book coming out, I immediately bought that. And that's how I got back in touch with the Welshman family through him. So that's very nice. Well, yes, with Roz, I communicated a bit and I've met Jenny today. So that's really nice.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah. So it's just a real pleasure to be here today.
Thanks so much for sharing the story.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
And then took a hut and set up.
I mean, Grandad did not, you know, in recounting these stories, but you could tell. It was by what he didn't say.
Hi, I'm Joel Greenberg. I'm at Bletchley Park today following the opening of an exhibition about Gordon Welshman, one of the key people of Bletchley Park during World War II. My privilege to be sitting with two veterans of Bletchley Park, James Thirsk, who actually worked with Gordon Welshman in Hut 6, and Betty Webb, worked another part of this vast organization, and the third member, Jenny Welshman, Gordon's granddaughter. And it's quite an interesting concept because on the one hand, we have Jimmy, do you mind me calling you Jimmy?
Yeah, Jimmy.
Jimmy, who actually worked with Gordon Welshman, and Jenny, who's an academic in her own right, who remembers her grandfather writing Hut 6 story and other papers. And before me, I have some interesting books. I actually have a copy of the first American edition of the Hut 6 story. I have my own biography of Gordon Welshman, and I have this lovely book, An Inmate Story, by James Thirsk as well. So Jimmy did write his own memoir as well. A nice way to start is to ask you, Jimmy, how you felt about the security. In other words, when did you feel that you could actually start talking about this stuff?
Well, after Winterbottom's book, The Ultra Secret, came out in 1974. I think it was published in America, but just before it came out here. But when it came out in 74, Winterbottom revealed most of what was going on. He didn't go into the mathematical details of how Enigma was cracked. I think a lot of his information was not strictly true because he was writing it from memory only. But after that, I felt I could tell people who asked me. Before that, often people who knew I'd been in the intelligence corps, I mean, during the war when I was at home on leave with my parents, people would see me in the street, and old friends, and say, what are you doing now? And I used to say, well, actually, I was originally with the Central Party, which Welshman mentions. The Central Party was at Bow Manor in Leicestershire. After I'd been there a month, we came over to Bletchley and attached to Hut 6. So the name Central Party was lost then. But I used to say to people, well, I'm with MI8 Communications, because Central Party was actually part of MI8, which was Communications. Mm. That usually satisfied people.
But what about later? I mean, when did you think you could actually write your own memoir?
Well, I don't remember, really. I'd written a couple of books of childhood and boyhood reminiscences, which came out before this. And then I began to have these memories of Bletchley and different stories and some funny. And I got the idea of also incorporating biographies of the leading people, not just Welshman and Turing, but I finished up with 50 short biographies, which comprises half the book, really, which is, I thought, useful because the names of Turing was so well known, but other names were not known so well, except by people who were at Bletchley. And I'd been collecting obituary notices that came out, and after Winterbottom, the obituary notices came out, all mentioned Bletchley, but before Winterbottom, those who died earlier, Bletchley, of course, was not mentioned. No. Mm-hmm. But the other point was that in my book, I've got a separate chapter on the fact that secrecy was not complete after the war, and that many journalists and writers referred to Bletchley, not necessarily by name, but some, even Muggeridge mentioned the name Bletchley. Mm-hmm. Because although Malcolm Muggeridge, the journalist, he was in intelligence during the war. He never served at Bletchley, but he did visit here apparently once. And he talked quite freely about this a couple of years before Winterbottom.
Mm. There was actually a book published in 1986, which you can still buy secondhand, called The Philby Conspiracy.
Oh, yes.
By Sunday Times journalists, where they go in great detail about Bletchley Park breaking naval codes. But it slipped under the radar, and I suspect it was the fact that Winterbottom's book was serialized in the Sunday Telegraph.
And Trevor Roper mentioned it as well. And also, not many people know this, but in the Pearl Harbor hearings, which account after the war in America, they had these numerous investigations into Pearl Harbor. There's a whole shelf full of volumes about it. And I saw these at Chatham House, and went through them and didn't read them all, but I skimmed through them and found that there was some references, even in 1946, about the fact that the British had been breaking German ciphers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They didn't mention it by name, Enigma, but it was mentioned. And they pleaded with Senator Dewey, I think it was, who was up for president. And he didn't get it, fortunately. He knew about the secret during the war, and they pleaded with him not to release a letter, but he disregarded it and released this letter. Mm. I can't remember all the details, but it revealed that the British had told the Americans that they were breaking Enigma, and it didn't mention the name Enigma, but it said, if this letter is published, we are compromising our position with the British about the secrecy and so on. And then it appeared in Time magazine and Life magazine, brief extracts about this. You see. Well, people read these things, and if they don't know the background, it flows over them.
Now, Betty, what about you and the secrecy? When did you think that you could actually start to talk about it?
I knew I could, quite by accident. I was working in Birmingham, and the day that the veil of secrecy was lifted, there was another former BP member on the other side of the street. I didn't know her name, but I knew her by sight, and she said, "It's out." So I said, "Oh, what's out?" She said, "Well, we can now talk." And that was the end of it. I didn't hear any more. And I had no wish to start chattering about it. It didn't occur to me for many years. In fact, I think it was about 1994 when I was at a party somewhere, and there was another army person there, you know, start chatting. And that was when I was encouraged to give talks. And that was when I started reading more books, mainly through Gordon Welshman's Hut 6 story, which started me off on being interested in reading other people's comments on it.
Jenny, within the family, I know that Gordon and Tini, his third wife, paid a visit to Britain, and when they saw that the book had been published, he then went back when he found out about Winterbottom's book. When they got back home to Newburyport, he had a dinner party and told friends, etc. Mm-hmm. When did the family itself, did he actually formally say anything to the family? When did the family start talking about it?
About the book or
about Bletchley?
About Bletchley. Well, he'd certainly told my father many years ago, and I think at some point, sort of, I can't remember when, decided to sort of sit down all the children and tell them a little bit more. So, but I think it was always my dad who knew probably most about what was going on. I never had a clue until also it was Winterbotham's book, and that made him feel that he could, you know, begin to talk about things. And then all of a sudden, you know, after never having a clue what he did, I didn't even know what he did when he was at MITRE. I had this vague idea he was an architect. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, you know, we're hearing not only about Hut 6, and of course there was talk about getting people together and who they could contact. Because originally Joel's book mentions that the idea was for a joint publication to get several people to come in, and he was only going to write one bit. And it was an amazing transformation. He never talked about the Second World War before that, except very occasionally some personal family anecdote. And then suddenly we're hearing all this detail. And he was enjoying it. He was, you know, reliving memories and recalling people whose names he hadn't felt safe saying out loud before, you know, in all those years. So he was having a great time.
Okay, so when the Hot Six story came out, I mean, Betty said obviously that attracted interest. I mean, what did you think when that came out? Did you think that Welshman Jimmy had revealed secrets that he shouldn't have revealed? Or?
No, I bought the book when it came out and read it, and no, it didn't strike me that he'd revealed anything he shouldn't have done, because I knew this background of all these revelations that had been made before, and I couldn't understand what the fuss was about later on.
Oh, it's interesting. Betty, do you feel the same then, that you couldn't understand?
Yes, I did. Well, I felt quite comfortable with it. It didn't bother me at that stage, because I didn't know anything about any other possible deviations.
So within the family, obviously the recent documentary on the BBC, I think, developed it quite nicely, the increasing pressure on your grandfather, which I think you articulated nicely in the documentary. You want to say a bit more about that?
Well, it was a shock that he got the pushback he did. He was certainly hoping that some people would take a little bit of notice of the book, although I think he expected it to be more a sort of inside response, people who knew something about security. He had been very concerned, or one of the things he'd been concerned about in that period in his career was what he thought was overconfidence that new kinds of computer security, I believe there was the talk about, was it the two-key method, encrypting things, that this was going to solve all problems with security. And he said one of the things he was hoping his book would get across is that it doesn't matter how secure your equipment is. As long as human beings use it, there is no such thing as a secure system, and there will always be things you can find out. So he really had hoped that people would not only read the book for the revelations about Hut 6 and the things that had gone on here, and that people like yourselves would finally get some of the credit you were long overdue for all the wonderful work that people had done here. But he was hoping that people would also think about the implications of what you'd managed to do, which is long before a computer gets built here, you're cracking a network, you know, and hundreds of, well, I don't know, thousands of messages a day, I suppose. Mm. But it's by using these other kinds of skills, the traffic analysis or metadata, as Joel points out, it's now called, and all the other techniques that you're using, and that those could be used at any time against any system and with success. He was hoping that would be picked up on. But we didn't expect it to generate the response that it did. That was a very difficult period.
So they're jumping around in time a bit. Because I'm so interested in the traffic analysis side and the log reading, I mean, can you give us to me just some idea of the scale of it? Because I understand there was like the logs, there's information associated with tens of thousands of messages being logged.
Oh, yes, it was an avalanche. It was like Niagara. The intercept operators all over the country, they had two pads. They put the messages down on one pad. They were normally sent originally by dispatch rider, but I think the urgency for messages, they were sent by teleprinter. But the logs themselves, which is all the other material, what Gordon Welshman called chit-chat between German operators, keeping in touch with each other, their headquarters and their outstation, to keep in touch all day long by using the Q code, which was an international three-letter code, Morse code QZA, was what is your signal strength. Mm. And these logs came in by dispatch rider, motorbike with two big panniers on the side. And I remember in the room where they were received, and the door opened, it was a winter at Bletchley, and a dispatch rider came and he was covered from head to foot with snow and carrying these two pannier bags and dumped them on. He shook the snow off him. He'd driven probably 60 miles through a terrible snowstorm. You know, the mail must go through. And the logs were not all that urgent. The messages were, but not the logs. We were quite a large group of people, 50 or 60, working different shift systems as well. But You had pigeonholes and these logs were sorted out by frequency, I think. So if you were on the day shift, you went in at 9, went to your pigeonhole, do up. You hoped a slim collection of logs, but sometimes it was this thick. Sort of groaned as you, because you had to go through every log and make notes and draw diagrams of who was talking to whom, using coloured pencils for different messages and so on. You often got 2 days off, moving from evening to night shift or night shift to day shift. You sort of wangled a couple of nights away, went off to London to the theatre and stayed a night in the YMCA or something like that. And you came back. Nobody had bothered to touch your logs. They were overflowing in the pigeonhole. You just had a great stack to deal with. I used to keep a diary in those days, just a pocket diary, a few brief comments about going out to the pub in the evening and that sort of thing. And sometimes I would put, shattered at work today, worked on till 5:30 before I finished. It was dull work and it was very monotonous. At that time, we didn't know that Enigma was being broken. We knew there were messages going and we used to speculate among ourselves whether these were being broken. But at Bow Manor, there was a separate room and the people inside were in the know and we weren't. Mm. And we weren't allowed in that room. But no. They came out to consult us about some call sign or other or some network. And then they would go back. They wouldn't tell us a thing. So we got very suspicious about this. Anyway, we'd been 6 months at Bletchley, and I think Gordon and Welshman had been advocating that the loggery should be told. And he gathers together in one of the huts, about 50 of us, I remember, and just told us the whole story about Enigma and how it was being broken. And of course, this gave a terrific boost to our morale, because then we could consult with the people in what they call later the fusion room. They were fusing information from the German messages with our information about networks and traffic analysis. And my future wife was in the fusion rooms. She was using her German, she had been studying German, to analyse contents of German messages. And they had a vast card index of names and places. And everything that was going on was noted on cards and then fused with our information from traffic analysis, and the results were put on a big wall map. Gordon Welshman, in his book, towards the end, he says that the central party attached to Hut 6 probably knew more about the Enigma transmission apparatus in Germany than the Germans themselves. And I thought that was a lovely quote.
Mm. So, I mean, Jenny, do you feel now that finally your grandfather has been given the recognition?
Yeah, it's been absolutely wonderful. We were thrilled with, I must say, your book, which I thought was fantastic. The things that he'd wanted to have happen by publishing his own book were finally happening. He hadn't perhaps managed to bring a lot of attention to Bletchley Park because that happened independently, and if anything, actually brought attention back to him, ironically. But he's helped to publicize things that people were doing at Bletchley, and its work has gotten recognition, and happily more of the veterans of Bletchley Park have been telling their story. That's wonderful. And yes, he would not have minded that he got a little, attention himself. I mean, he was not pompous, but not falsely modest, I think, either.
But do you feel that America is getting to know more about our role in the war?
Starting to, yes. Probably better than in Canada, where I'm living now. And it's had an interesting offshoot, which might interest you as a veteran of Bletchley Park, that precisely because the code-breaking operation has gotten better known here, finally some Americans who were in a similar sort of position, working on Japanese codes, for example, about whom absolutely nothing was said in official history books. There was a documentary just a couple of years ago and some books coming out on work. They, of course, knew what you were doing and were no doubt trying to use some of the same techniques.
I think there are certain sections of Canada where the story is being told, because I have a connection in Montreal. It just so happens that the family own a newspaper there. They've told me recently that quite a bit of news, I'm not being pompous here, but through me, has filtered through.
There's a website that has several contributions from, I guess they were Canadian wrens.
We've recently included some interviews of Canadian wrens who've suddenly just popped up.
Wonderful, yes. I think that's down to probably the Bletchley Park Circle program has helped spread it out and perhaps reach people who communicated with people who were here before who might not have done so, you know, by, say, picking up the Hut 6 story, which, as Joel mentioned earlier, is a kind of tough read in places for people who aren't familiar with it.
I think there's still a lot of mysteries about intelligence during the war. For example, were the Russians also breaking Enigma? It's never been revealed. Even the doctored messages to the commanders in the field, like Montgomery or Eisenhower or any Patton or any of the others. Montgomery obviously knew, and probably his right-hand man knew, but nobody else. And the special liaison units attached to each commander in the field, they knew the information and passed it on. But it didn't go any further at all. Yeah. And they were very careful about this.
I mean, for me, the best evidence that the Germans didn't know that the Enigma was compromised was that whenever they did enhance security, which you would do as a matter of course anyway, they would send out instructions to the operators telling them what changes were about to be made, encrypting them with the existing system. So you all knew in advance that they were about to change something. So that's pretty good evidence that they really didn't believe that the system was compromised.
The other thing that a lot of people don't know is that over a whole year they'd been studying call signs, and they were able to predict and make a call sign book, because the German operator of a particular station who would say call sign GHQ, next day he would look in the book and find his call sign for the next day, change at midnight. Well, apparently two or three of them had been working on this for a whole year, and they worked out so they could predict what the call sign would be. And they'd only just completed that when the Russians captured one of these call signs books and handed it to the British. So we had it anyway. And
it's called the Bird Book.
The Bird Book. One of my frequent memories about Bletchley, we only had one copy of the Bird Book. And, of course, every day all the log readers wanted to use it to find out the change in call sign. And it was kept on a central desk. And then you'd suddenly hear someone, has anybody seen the Bird Book? And some guilty person who'd kept it on their desk, you know, failed to return it. It was passed around all the time, so it was well thumbed.
Well, it still exists. It's at GCHQ. That's been really a good chat. It's just wonderful to bring multiple generations together. You know, Gordon Welshman obviously was the reason we were all here today at Bletchley Park. Lovely to have former colleagues of his here, as well as a member of his family.
It's a lovely
gathering to...
It's a pity we haven't something strong to drink.
I couldn't agree more. With water, a little toast to Gordon Welshman. Well said.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.